Hi everyone, I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. From Baylor College of Medicine, an article published in the European Journal of Preventive Cardiology, chocolate is good for your heart. Yes, eating chocolate at least once a week is linked with a reduced risk of heart disease. That's good news. More on that later, along with a lot of other health and nutrition articles. Also today, I'm going to bring you up to date on some of the incorrect information that we've been given about the Corona 19 virus and why this is important as they close in on the so-called miracle vaccines. And by the way, there's over 100 in production. What will this mean when they have the vaccine? Hundreds of billions of dollars are at stake, minimally, and they're going to mandate it. They're not telling you the truth. We will. Also today, we're going to take a look at meeting the enemy. A feminist comes to terms with the men's rights movement. Oh, you didn't know there was a men's rights movement? You haven't heard about it? Because almost everything is based on women's rights, and women should have all those rights. So should men. But they don't. But it took an interesting introspection by an attorney, a feminist, to give us this TED talk. I think you'll find it of interest. Also, all the coddling of the American mind. Kind of interesting, because just imagine that there's a young person, 19, 20 years old, college student at an elite university, and she's in the face, she's Caucasian, and she's in the face of a African-American police officer, a woman, who is saying nothing. And the woman is screaming racial epithets, giving her the finger, and demeaning her. And then a guy is making statements about an African-American man and demeaning him, making racial epithets. And the media doesn't cover that at all. It's there. You can see it. And yet, a month later, that same woman screaming, cursing, now takes offense in a class at the potential for a speaker to come and give a talk on a topic. Feels so threatened that her existence is at stake, which means that all these universities have special rooms and therapists and administrators, a whole army to coddle them. What have we become? And these are the people who are allowed to be racist? Is it possible then, we're told no, I disagree, is it possible for anti-racists to engage in racism, blatant racism? Your thoughts, because we're going to deal with that today. And Professor Jonathan Haidt will be giving us his perspective on that. I'm interested in yours. Plus, I'm going to give you the latest on the environment. Things are happening at a very rapid pace around the world, and we're not being made aware of it, and we should. There's a huge, and I mean huge, we're talking about over a billion people who are now engaged in having to move someplace. They have no means to move. They have nowhere to go. They're not welcomed anywhere. How are they supposed to get from point A to point B? I'll give you an example of one, a very real, specific example of a family who had to leave their home in Central America because there was drought. And then when the drought stopped and they planted some corn, in came flooding and destroyed it. They had nothing left. They were starving. They're not alone. Why aren't we caring about them? Do they not matter? Hungry children, hungry people, without any resources or place to go? Shouldn't we care? Shouldn't we be creating environmental safe zones for these people? Couldn't we spend money taken from the military-industrial complex budget, maybe let's say $200 billion a year? That would only be about 12 to 14% of their budget, and shifted over to building sustainable communities where 1,000, 2,000 people could live a quality of life, schools, hospital, food production, a nice place for families to live, so they could have another start at life. These are good people. And yet, nothing is being done for them. So, I have some ideas there. But we always start with health and nutrition. Now, according to this study from Baylor College of Medicine, which, by the way, is down in Houston, Texas, there are thousands of studies now on cacao, which is raw chocolate, and it's good for your blood pressure. It's good for the lining of the blood vessels, the endothelium. It's also good as an antioxidant. It helps your coronary arteries. And the coronary arteries are the ones that supply, these blood vessels supply the heart. And so it's extremely important that anything at all that we can do to help our heart, like vitamin E and coenzyme Q10 and magnesium, they all help your heart. But in this study of 336,000 participants, it was about eating chocolate. And they found that chocolate helped their heart and hence prevented coronary artery disease progression and hence allowed blood flow to the heart that would otherwise have been blocked. So that's something new and that's something good. This is from Rensselaer Polytech Institute, a new study published in the highly respected peer-reviewed journal Cell Discovery. And it says in cell studies, seaweed extract, we're talking about just a seaweed extract, outperformed remdesivir in blocking COVID-19 virus. Now, I'm going to give you more on that particular superstar, all in, praise it, never condemn it, because it's not a superstar. It's a superstar public relations gimmick. And we're going to expose that today. But seaweed outperformed it. Why don't we hear about seaweed? Oh, you can't patent it. You can't make a multi-billion dollar company, you know, richer by saying, well, our drug, let me spell it for you, R-E-M-D-E-S-I-V-I-R, we hoped it would do well. We promoted that it was going to do well in just, you know, cell culture, but it didn't. But that's all right. We have a lot of influence over the media, and the media gets behind superstars. But seaweed, which is dirt cheap, natural, non-toxic, it outperformed it, just so you know. So in a test of antiviral effectiveness against the virus that causes corona-19, an extract of edible seaweeds substantially outperformed the most popular drug that they're promoting for the public, which is the current standard antiviral used to combat the disease. Heparin, a common blood thinner, and heparin variant stripped of its anticoagulant properties, performed on par with the drug. So that's what we're up to. There are going to be hundreds, if not thousands, of drugs that they're looking at to see does it have antiviral activity, instead of looking something natural like curcumin, for example, vitamin C. From the Norwegian University of Science and Technology comes a study about mindfulness training helps men manage anger. Now, we've seen a lot of violence, domestic violence, people trapped in an environment, and they're out of work. They may not have work. They're out of money and sometimes out of food. And so people get angry. So the last several months have been particularly difficult for people living in a violent relationship. But now there is some hope. And for a lot of people, the shutdown has been an extreme situation with lots of stress. And they're finding that mindful meditation can make a big difference and help keep things in perspective so you don't let that anger out on people around you, or yourself for that matter. So something good, mindful meditation once again comes through. I mentioned yesterday that there were a couple university studies that showed that cannabinol was good for helping with post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms. Now a new journal study from the University of Colorado and Colorado State University has reconfirmed that. Researchers examined the clinical benefits of the cannabidiol, that's CBD, for patients with post-traumatic stress disorder, and their findings were published in the Journal of Alternative and Complementary Medicine. And by the way, CBD is a non-psychometric cannabinoid compound that can be found in plants from the genus Cannabis line. And this was beneficial, and that's important. It's inexpensive, it's non-toxic, and it works. That's what people with post-traumatic stress disorder need. From Oxford University comes a study published in the British Medical Journal Neuroscience that antibiotics disrupt the development of the social brain, and that's important. This was a laboratory experiment. So what it means is this. Antibiotic treatment in early life, and look at all the different children getting antibiotic treatment for inner ear infections, for upper respiratory tract infections, for autoimmune infections, for chronic allergies. And that's not what you should be giving, but that's what pediatricians are giving. It actually impedes brain signaling pathways that function in social behavior and pain regulation, in this case in mice, and therefore could be applied to humans as well. We've just way overused antibiotics. And if you want to know how badly we're overusing it, over half of all antibiotics are fed to animals. See, it was found back in the 1960s that by feeding antibiotics to cattle, they gained weight without having to eat more food. And nobody cared about the fact that the antibiotics are coming through in the meat or in the dairy. But they do. And so therefore, we're getting small amounts of antibiotics on a regular daily basis into our body if you eat the average American diet of meat and dairy, and then your body no longer has the mechanisms available because you've developed a tolerance and then a resistance, meaning you have to take more to get the same effect, and then after taking it for so long, it's not working, and then it works against you. And then one day you end up with an infection and MRSA, which is a methicillin-resistant bacterium, takes over and can kill you. It's killing thousands of people each year. And people in hospital are most susceptible, but people don't go to hospital because they're healthy. They go to hospital because they're sick. And then you get a cold, the doctor gives you antibiotics. But antibiotics are very specific. They do not work on virus. They work on bacteria. So why would you give an antibiotic for someone who's suffering from a viral infection? It makes no sense. You give an antiviral if you're an orthodox doctor, okay. Or you build up the person's immune system, because ultimately all healing is self-healing. And medicine at its best simply complements that process and block some of the pathogenic activity from occurring so you can regain your strength. Why do you think in Italy, in France, in Japan, in Sweden, Switzerland, they have for decades and decades and decades, they have these mineral water baths you go to? Now, I've gone there. You're given a bathrobe, you walk around all day, you sit out in the water, you drink water, they bring you water all day long. And to cleanse, detoxify, and de-stress, to build up the immune system again. We don't do that in the United States. And we should. We don't do a lot of stuff that other countries have done for a long time that we could benefit from. From Siberian Federal University in Russia, buckwheat enhances the production of protein that supports longevity. Now, this is brand new. Now, we already know that a low-calorie diet, a healthy plant-based clean diet, and juicing, supplements, and exercise is great for our health and longevity. Well, this is a low-calorie plant, and it's extremely good, and it improves the level of what is called sirtuin-1, or SIRT-1, protein production that is known to increase life expectancy. A team of scientists from an experimental university, found that buckwheat affected the health of laboratory animals, and the only known method to optimize the level of this protein is a caloric-restrictive diet. Hence, what I advocate, what I engage in, is fasting throughout the day and not always eating, and then fasting with an early dinner and nothing until the next morning. 12-hour fast every day is really good for you, and then one day a week, just juice and smoothies throughout the day, no solid food. When you restrict calories, you lengthen the lifespan. That's the bottom line, and that's non-disputed in science. The article was published in the Journal of Cereal Science. So I think that's important, especially now, as a society, we're beginning to understand the importance of a healthy digestive system, healthy probiotics in our colon, getting rid of highly acidic foods like alcohol and coffee, sugar and meat, fried foods. So this CERT1 is a protein that senses nutrient status of cells. And when CERT1 levels in a cell are intentionally increased, its aging process slows down and its stress resistance improves. So buckwheat is one grain that can do that for you. So something to think about. One more piece to the puzzle. Also important is our love hormone. One of the lessons that I suggested to someone who was going through a really rough time, a lot of loss in this person's family, was find a puppy and just give it a lot of love. Person thought it was stupid initially, but they got a dog, and now the person called and says, "Wow, you were right." And what is it? I mean, you said pet the puppy for at least 30 minutes. I said, well, what you're doing, you're allowing the love hormone, oxytocin, that's O-X-Y-T-O-C-I-N, that's different than oxycontin, which is really bad, and you should never have that. In any case, that's for pain, and it leads to addiction and a lot of death. But oxytocin is what happens when you hold hands, when you hug each other, when you cuddle, when you watch children play, when you love your animals, kisses, hugs, intimacy. You're really creating a lot of the love hormone, and that is good for you and your immune system. Scientists discovered for the first time that oxytocin could be a potential new therapeutic option for cognitive disorders like Alzheimer's disease. So at Tokyo University of Sciences, they tested this. Now, we know that Alzheimer's disease is a progressive disorder in which the nerve cells called neurons in a person's brain and the connections among them degenerate slowly, causing severe memory loss and intellectual deficiencies and deterioration in motor skills and communication. One of the main causes of Alzheimer's is the accumulation of a protein called amyloid B. It gets together in clusters around the neurons in the brain, which hampers their activity and triggers their degeneration. Well, studies have found that increasing the aggregation of amyloid B in the hippocampus, the brain's main learning and memory center, causes a decline in the signal transmission potential of the neurons, and this degeneration affects specific traits of the neurons called synaptic plasticity, which is the ability of synapses, that, by the way, a synapsis is the site of signal exchange between neurons, to adapt to an increase or decrease in signaling activity over time. And synaptic plasticity is crucial to the development of learning and cognitive functions in the hippocampus. So when you are engaged in something that you feel deep, warm love with, you're helping your brain. You're helping on all levels, especially you're helping to prevent the amyloid B-induced cognitive impairment. The findings, by the way, were published in the Biochemical and Biophysical Research Communications. And also from New York University School of Medicine, published in the Lancet Diabetes and Endocrinology, evidence of hormone disruptor chemical threats grow. A growing number of chemicals and pesticides, flame retardants, certain plastics have been linked to widespread health problems, including diabetes and impaired brain development. And there are hundreds of these studies. One more reason to go natural wherever possible, organic, and get rid of all the chemicals that you can, we can't get rid of everything in our lives, but as much as you can, don't hold that cell phone up to your ear, use it on speaker, or get the cords. Don't sit right up to your computer, don't use Wi-Fi, because all these are endocrine disruptors, and that adversely affects your health. I'm Gary Nall. We are 21 minutes into our program. We're going to take a break, and when we come back from the break, we're going to hear a discussion between Bill Maher and Professor Jonathan Haidt. That's H-A-I-D-T. He's a remarkable thinker. And he's going to talk about the coddling of the American mind, because when you do something long enough, and if enough people believe that it's important and right, it becomes the new norm. And now anything or anyone that challenges that is now looked upon as a heretic. How dare you challenge how we feel? And our feelings are more important than anything else. And suddenly that becomes the new norm. And now the silent majority can't do anything about it, because it becomes the law when the right people, meaning those in power, legislators, believe to, and these are just really sociopaths, you realize, the legislators, most of them, but to keep in power, they will pass laws and bills that support these absurd notions of human behavior. And then you telling the truth would seem like you're engaged in a tyrannical act. That's the irony. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Last thing we need in this country is another reason for democracy to be threatened. But your book says we have one. It's the darn kids today. Explain that a little. I'm paraphrasing. You're an actual eminent professor. You say it in better words than I just did, please.
Sure. Well, the book has its origins in an observation from my co-author, Greg Lukianoff. He is the president of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, defends free speech rights on campus. And in 2013, Greg began noticing that for the first time, it was the students who were asking for protections from words and books and ideas and speakers. Previously, students had protested speakers before, but they'd never before medicalized it. They acted as though if this person says something, I will be harmed, damaged, people will be traumatized. And so this was something new. And when they put it in terms of safety, well, then administrators have to respond. So this came in around 2013, 2014, and it brought with it a whole package of innovations, you might say, microaggression training, safe spaces, trigger warnings. All this stuff appears from out of nowhere around 2013, 2014.
That's something I did not realize until I was reading your book. I thought it went back further, because I've been talking about the fragile stuff for a long time, but I didn't realize that this is a new generation. The millennials stop at 1995?
1994, that's right.
Okay, so now we're into the iGen, you call them, or Generation Z?
Right, same thing, that's right.
And they're even more fragile.
Yeah. Well, so this is something that...
Who can we blame? Let's start blaming. I want to blame. Let's play the blame game.
Okay.
I say
well,
parents.
Let's see.
You go.
Okay, we'll do all the parents and we'll do all the teachers. So, yeah, the basic finding, which I think surprised a lot of us assumed that the millennials were from 1982 to around 2000 or 1998. But kids born around 1995 had a very different childhood from kids born a few years before. And so research by Gene Twenge and others show that kids born after 1985, they don't get driver's licenses as much. They don't drink as much. They don't go out on dates. They don't have sex as much. What are they doing? They're sitting at home on their devices, talking with each other. And this seems to be changing social development. And we know this. This is not just some, you know, perception from outsiders, because the rates of anxiety disorders, depression, self-cutting, where they have to be admitted to hospitals, and suicide, all of these rates are way, way up, especially for girls, and it all begins right around 2011. And so it's when this generation first enters college campuses, and 2013, that's when all this new attitude about speech comes in.
Isn't another reason that they're sitting home instead of doing all those fun things is because the parents insist on watching them all the time?
Exactly.
I remember 20 years ago, we talked about helicopter parents, you know, hovering over them. And now they call it bulldozer parenting.
Yep.
They clear out any obstacles in the
concierge
way.
Concierge parenting, I've heard.
Right. Yeah. So that the kid doesn't have to ever face any difficulties. How can that kid function in the real world?
That's right. So the most important psychological idea in the book is anti-fragility, that there are some things that are fragile, like a wine glass. If you knock it over, it breaks. Nothing good happens. If something is plastic, you knock it over, it doesn't get damaged, but it doesn't get better. But there are some things that have to be stressed or challenged, like the immune system. If you protect your kid's immune system, right, use bacterial wipes, you're actually hurting the kid. You're preventing the system from getting the information it needs. Same thing with social life. If you protect your kids from being excluded, from being insulted, from being teased, when they grow up, it's like the princess and the pea, a little tiny thing that they encounter on campus now becomes intolerably painful.
But it's not all over the country, really, is it? I mean, this is something when they talk about elites, this is who we're talking about, I think, a little more than the heartland.
Well,
you know,
the
kids who are you, Mom. You know, I call them the fuck you, Mom generation.
Now, I mean, in New York, too.
Yeah, I mean, calling mom a bitch, turning their back on when their mother's talking. If I did that, I would not be sitting here today. The constant negotiating with the kids, you know. Hey, buddy.
Yeah.
Ready to go?
That's right. That's right. Kids need structure and authority, and when parents try too hard to be their friends. Yeah. But on the point about whether this is everywhere, so this is such a new trend. We only began to notice these things in the last couple of years. But what seems to be the case is that the anxiety and depression, the fragility, the mental illness, that's across the country, across social classes, across races. And that's why social media use is beginning early, beginning in middle school. That seems to be the most likely culprit of several culprits. So that's all over the country. But the shout-downs, the screaming at professors, we've mapped that out. That is almost only in the Northeast and just the coastal strip of the West Coast and a little bit in Chicago.
But that's what gets the headlines, and that's what dominates media. See, it's the kid who's screaming at the professor who then gets a job at the Huffington Post.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And provides fodder for right-wing media to say, look how terrible.
And the problem with liberals in general is that they let those kids who are at the Huffington Post or whatever writing their insane woke shit.
Hear, hear.
They let them control the debate, just like the parents let the kid control when we're leaving.
Yeah.
We've let the kids take over. Mm-hmm. That's like job one don't do in civilizations.
No, that's right. There is.
You respect the elders. That's like every civilization before this one, because they might be wiser. But to connect it to this point of why we lose, I think that's relevant. I think people in this country don't anymore pay attention to policy so much. It's more this personal stuff. It's anecdotal. I don't know about global warming or what causes a recession. But, you know, I saw that mother at the soccer game or in the supermarket, and her five-year-old was screaming at her, and she was apologizing to the five-year-old. I'm not going to let those people take over the country.
And
I think that's the level it works on.
And to give Donald Trump his due, I think he understands that, because he's a guy who thinks that global warming is a Chinese hoax, but he knows how to attach derogatory nicknames to people, and that's a lot of his success in politics.
The sanitization of these social media sites, you know, you have a kid puts beautiful pictures of themselves on the site, and then another kid looks at it and feels that their life is less than that beautiful sanitization. Is that affecting them as well and creating a lot of this anxiety?
Absolutely. And that's probably the main reason why it's affecting the girls so much more than the boys. Because if you imagine, you know, all of the kids in America around 2007 to 2009, and you suddenly just drop millions and millions of iPhones all over the country and kids pick them up, what are the boys going to do? oh, video games. And it turns out, actually, video games aren't that harmful.
And porn.
Well,
no, really. That's, yeah. And that's not a joke.
Yeah, motorboating.
That is,
yeah.
Yeah. Oh, Doc.
But just to finish up here, so the boys are mostly doing video games, which aren't so bad. Even if they're running around imaginary worlds killing people, as my son does with his friends, it's really cooperative, there's teamwork, they're talking. But what the girls are doing... What the girls are doing is putting something out and then waiting anxiously while people comment on it.
Right.
And so it's the social comparison, it's the fear of missing out. Also, girls' bullying is relational, boys' bullying is physical, so social media doesn't really affect
right.
it. But girls can never get away if they're being bullied. So this is why we think the suicide rate is up 25% for boys, but it's up 70% for girls.
Okay, very serious issues. Now, I just want to keep reminding people that at some point, we have to intercede and have some form of dialogue if people are open to it. You can't force an idea on anyone, because those of us who grew up understanding responsibilities, personal responsibilities, understanding the importance of society and family, morals and character, manners and understanding of history, critical thinking, and you see so many of these virtues gone today. In fact, one of the things that's gone at this moment are the corporate Democrat and liberals within that movement. And on the one hand, I think, why? Why are they doing all these things that are so counterintuitive and counterproductive to healing? Why can't we be a nation that starts off with the idea of wanting to come together, and you do that by forgiveness? We have to have forgiveness as a part of our commentary and believe it in order to get beyond what indiscretions, what violence, what abuses have occurred in the past to where we get to where we want to go forward, and how can we? Now, many people have already done this. You would think that if you looked at the news today, which I do not recommend people doing because it's all propaganda, that we are a society engaged in a new civil war. It's not true. The vast, vast majority of human beings have been living meaningful lives. They're decent, ethical people. They're people who may not be aware of everything they should be doing or the world around them, but they're not making the world necessarily a battlefield. Now with the coronavirus, they've been all knocked down. I mean, it's terrible out there. And it's getting worse, and it's going to get a lot worse. So what is the ultimate motive? What do people hope to gain by this? Power. I've never counseled a person in my life who was very rich and famous. Now, I have about 3,000 of the almost 70,000 I've counseled have been extremely wealthy, who felt that whatever they had was enough to allow them the security to stop making money and put their energy into philanthropic work or helping those who do not have by sharing their resources to do something that leaves a legacy where other people can live a better life because of them. They all want the last crumb on the table for themselves. That's unfortunate. One of the people speaking up against this and in return being attacked for it, well, there's several. Max Blumenthal of Gray Zone and The Intercept. Julian Assange was talking about this. Chris Hedges, Abby Martin. We have probably 400 or 500 individuals in our society, which is not much in a country of 331 million people, who are speaking out at great risk to their reputations, because we're now in a shaming society. First, we shame you, whether what we're shaming you about is honest or not, or accurate or not. We do not need any jurisprudence. If you're accused, you're guilty. There is no one, well, why don't we wait until we see whether a person is guilty? No, no, no. Our feelings are you're guilty. Then what we shame you with, we have to destroy you. Now, this is so rotten, it's right up there with red baiting and McCarthyism. Legitimate people's reputations for doing nothing that would historically be considered improper are now finding they can't say anything, and so people are terrified. So thank you for those who do stand up. Now let's go to some of the latest information that I think is I think we should know more about, especially since we're being, in effect, railroaded into accepting that everything the government tells us about the COVID virus is real. But I want to get several other issues in as well. For example, a new study published by Jen Eastgate says that antipsychotic medications don't prevent, actually cause psychosis. This is a brand new study published in the Australian and New Zealand Journal of Psychiatry. And for all of us for years who were saying, why is it that the number one side effect on antidepressant medication is depression and also suicidal ideation? And what about the one of the top side effects of the antipsychotic medication is psychoses? Oh, no, that can be true. Well, it is true. And in fact, it's happening. So I think that's very important. Stay off these meds. They're not good for you. And they cause what they claim to cure. Now, from Zero Hedge, Tyler Durin, is a new study. And this is from the State Department of Public Health in Connecticut. Quote, 90 people in the state of Connecticut were found to actually have been negative for coronavirus after receiving positive tests. And then they found, quote, a flaw in one of its testing systems, and that of the 90 out of 144 people who were tested for the virus between June 15th and June 17th received false positive tests. That's terrible. Many of those who received the false test were nursing home residents. So think of how many other flaws there have been out there because there is no 100% gold standard antibody test at this time. Also from Vanderbilt University Medical Center comes a study about the health and well-being and food security of families deteriorating under COVID-19. Quote, this was in today's Pediatrics. The ongoing disruptive changes of efforts to reduce the spread of COVID-19 are having a substantial negative impact on the physical and mental well-being of parents and their children across the country, according to a new national survey published today in Pediatrics. Families are particularly affected by stressors stemming from changes in work, school, and daycare schedules that are impacting finances and access to community support networks. Wow. That's terrible. I'm one of those who believe that the science, and I'm a scientist, so I read the scientific literature carefully every day, clearly, unequivocally shows that there's no reason in the world not to open up schools and not to open up daycare centers. These are the least susceptible in our society. And if there's a teacher who is susceptible, though I don't support the television broadcasting or teaching by remote, most of the teachers are under 49 years of age, in which case there's little probability that they would ever be infected by students. And now with every student having to spray hydrogen peroxide on their desks and clean it down, you know, wear some gloves, there's no reason in the world not to have children back in school and relieve this stress, which is clearly detrimental to people's health. Also, this is the latest, same adjuvant in swine flu vaccine that caused narcolepsy also being used in coronavirus vaccine. Quote, numerous drug giants, including GlaxoSmithKline and Sanofi, are busily working to develop new vaccines for the Wuhan coronavirus 19. And we have learned that an adjuvant created by GlaxoSmithKline, that it was linked to causing narcolepsy during the 2009 H1N1 swine flu pandemic, is also slated to be used in these upcoming Wuhan coronavirus vaccines. Known as ASO3, this adjuvant is part of a proprietary prophylactic technology developed by GlaxoSmithKline. So anyhow, once again, we're finding what's wrong with how they're making these vaccines. Also, from the New York Times, Abram Lustgarten, the great climate migration. Remember I predicted this? I said you're going to have hundreds of millions, then billions of people starting now who have to migrate because they can't live off the land. It's too hot or too wet, and they're poor, and there's nothing being done to help them. Here's what it says, quote, early in 2019, a year before the world shut its borders completely, George A. knew he had to get out of Guatemala. The land was turning against him. For 5 years, it never rained. Then it did rain, and he rushed his last seeds into the ground. The corn sprouted into healthy green stalks. There was hope, until without warning, the river flooded. He waded chest deep into his fields, searching in vain for cobs he could still eat. Soon he made a last desperate bet, signing away the tin-roof hut where he lived with his wife and three children against a $1,500 advance in okra seed. But after the flood, the rain stopped again and everything died. He knew then that if he didn't get out of Guatemala, his family might die also. Even as hundreds of thousands of Guatemalans fled north toward the United States in recent years, the region, a state called Alta Verapaz, where precipitous mountains covered in coffee plantations and dense dry forests give way to broader gentle valleys, the residents have largely stayed. Now, though, under relentless confluence of drought, flood, bankruptcy, and starvation, they too have begun to leave. Almost everyone here experiences some degree of uncertainty about where their next meal will come from. Half the children are chronically hungry, and many are short for their age. With weak bones and bloated bellies, their families are all facing the same excruciating decision that confronts him. So remember, this is happening as one example. It's going to be happening across areas of the United States as well, where the new mega drought is underway. California, Nevada, Oklahoma, Kansas, much of Texas, Arizona are also going to be places that are not sustainable because of drought. Now, we're going to end our program by hearing someone who has something very interesting to say about what she thought was, what are you talking about, a men's movement? Who needs a men's movement? She was very prejudiced. She is a feminist. She's a lawyer, highly educated, and aware of many of the feminist issues. But listen to her TED Talk. It's very enlightening and very empowering.
In 2013, I decided to meet my enemies. I was a 27-year-old award-winning documentary filmmaker and a proud feminist. And I was determined to expose the dark underbelly of the men's rights movement. At that point, all I knew of the men's rights movement was from what I read online, that it's a misogynistic hate group actively working against women's equality. While the vast majority of my previous work was about women's issues, I directed documentaries about reproductive rights, single motherhood, and the need for more girls to get into STEM education. So when I learned that no one had ever documented the men's rights movement in a film before, I saw it as an opportunity to continue fighting for women's equality by exposing those preventing it. So for 1 year, I traveled North America, meeting the leaders and followers of the men's rights movement. I spent anywhere from 2 hours up to 8 hours interviewing each individual men's rights activist, also known as MRA. And I filmed 44 people total. And there's an important rule in documentary filmmaking. As an interviewer, you do not interrupt. So I'm asking questions, and I'm getting their full life story. And in the moment, I didn't realize it. But now, looking back, I can see that while I was conducting my interviews, I wasn't actually listening. I was hearing them speak, and I knew the cameras were recording. But in those moments of sitting across from my enemy, I wasn't listening. What was I doing? I was anticipating. I was waiting to hear a sentence, or even just a couple of words in succession, that proved what I wanted to believe, that I had found the misogynist, the ground zero of the war on women. A couple of times, I thought I had it, there was one men's rights activist that said to me, "Just walk outside and look around. Everything you see was built by a man." Ooh, his statement felt anti-women. I felt my jaw clench, but I sat quietly, as a documentarian should, while removing all the space between my upper and lower molars. After my year of filming, I was reviewing the 100 hours of footage I had gathered, replaying and transcribing it, which, believe me when I say, no one will ever listen to you more than someone who transcribes your words. You should write that down. So, I was typing out every word meticulously, and through that process, I began to realize that my initial knee-jerk reactions to certain statements weren't really warranted, and my feeling offended didn't hold up to intense scrutiny. Was that statement about men having built the skyscrapers and the bridges anti-women? I thought, well, what would be the gender reverse scenario? Maybe a feminist saying, just look around. Everyone you see was birthed by a woman. Wow, that's a powerful statement. And it's true. Is it anti-male? I don't think so. I think it's acknowledging our unique and valued contributions to our society. Well, luckily, while I was making the Red Pill movie, I kept a video diary, which ended up tracking my evolving views. And in looking back on the 37 diaries I recorded that year, there was a common theme. I would often hear an innocent and valid point that a men's rights activist would make, but in my head, I would add on to their statement a sexist or anti-woman spin, assuming that's what they wanted to say but didn't. So here are two examples of how that would go. A men's rights activist, an MRA, would say to me, "There are over 2,000 domestic violence shelters for women in the United States, but only one for men. Yet multiple reputable studies show that men are just as likely to be abused." I would hear them say, "We don't need 2,000 shelters for women. They're all lying about being abused. It's all a scam." But in looking back on all the footage I'd gathered of men's rights activists talking about shelters, and all the blogs they've written, and the video live streams they posted on YouTube, they're not trying to defund women's shelters, not at all. All they're saying is that men can be abused too, and they deserve care and compassion. Second example, a men's rights activist would say to me, "Where is justice for the man who was falsely accused of raping a woman? And because of this accusation, he loses his college scholarship and is branded with the inescapable title of rapist." I would hear them say, "A woman being raped isn't a big deal." It's as if I didn't hear the word falsely accused of rape. All I heard was he was accused of rape. Of course, rape is a big deal, and all the men's rights activists I met agreed it is a horrible thing to have happened to anyone. I eventually realized what they're saying is they're trying to add to the gender equality discussion, who is standing up for the good-hearted, honorable man that loses his scholarship, his job, or worse yet, his children, because he's accused of something he absolutely did not do? Well, I couldn't keep denying the points they were making. There are real issues. But in my effort to avoid agreeing with my enemy completely, I changed from putting words in their mouth to acknowledging the issue, but insisting they are women's issues. So here are two examples of how that would go. A men's rights activist would say to me, "Men are far more likely to lose their child in a custody battle." And I would counter, "Well, because women are unfairly expected to be the caretaker, it's discrimination against women that women get custody more often." Yeah. I'm not proud of that. second example, an MRA would say to me, men are roughly 78% of all suicides throughout the world. And I would counter with, but women attempt suicide more often. So ha. Ha. It's not a contest, but I kept making it into one. Why couldn't I simply learn about men's issues and have compassion for male victims without jumping at the opportunity to insist that women are the real victims? Well, after years of researching and fact-checking what the men's rights activists were telling me, there is no denying that there are many human rights issues that uniquely or disproportionately affect men. Paternity fraud uniquely affects men. The United States Selective Service, in the case of a draft, still uniquely affects men. Workplace deaths, disproportionately men. War deaths, overwhelmingly men. Suicide, overwhelmingly men. Sentencing disparity, life expectancy, child custody, child support, false rape allegations, criminal court bias, misandry, failure to launch, boys falling behind in education, homelessness, veterans issues, infant male genital mutilation, lack of parental choice once a child is conceived, lack of resources for male victims of domestic violence. So many issues that are heartbreaking if you are the victim or you love someone who is the victim of any one of these issues. These are men's issues, and most people can't name one because they think, well, men have all the rights. They have all the power and privilege. But these issues deserve to be acknowledged. They deserve care, attention, and motivation for solutions. Before making the Red Pill movie, I was a feminist of about 10 years, and I thought I was well-versed on gender equality issues. But it wasn't until I met men's rights activists that I finally started to consider the other side of the gender equality equation. It doesn't mean I agreed with all that they said, but I saw the immense value in listening to them and trying to see the world through their eyes. I thought if I could get my audience to also listen to them, it could serve as a rung on the ladder, bringing us all up to a higher consciousness about gender equality. So in October 2016, the film was released in theaters, and articles and critic reviews started to roll in. And that's when I experienced how engaged the media is in groupthink around gender politics. And I learned a difficult lesson. When you start to humanize your enemy, you, in turn, may be dehumanized by your community. And that's what happened to me. Rather than debating the merit of the issues addressed in the film, I became the target of a smear campaign. And people who had never seen the movie protested outside the theater doors, chanting that it was harmful to women. It certainly is not. But I understand their mindset. If I never made this movie and I heard that there was a documentary screening about men's rights activists that didn't show them as monsters, I too would have protested the screenings or at least signed the petitions to ban the film because I was told that they were my enemy. I was told that men's rights activists were against women's equality. But all the men's rights activists I met support women's rights and are simply asking the question, why doesn't our society care about men's rights? Well, the greatest challenge I faced through this whole process, it wasn't the protests against my film, and it wasn't how I was treated by the mainstream media, even though it got pretty disgusting at times. The greatest challenge I faced was peeling back the layers of my own bias. It turns out I did meet my enemy while filming. It was my ego saying that I was right and they were subhuman.
I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening and have a nice day.